And our next speaker is David Bosworth. David works in the fields of architecture and engineering at Build Lab near Ithaca, New York. He has been working in information technologies, design and analysis of the built environment for 15 years. Let's welcome David.
Good morning. Can you hear me in the back okay? Great. Thank you all for coming out so early this morning on the last day of the conference. I'm going to talk about cloud computing and as it relates to building energy simulation. You know, this is a topic that people discuss quite a lot, and it's becoming more and more available and more easy to access. So I'd like to talk about what exactly a cloud is, how you use it directly, and how the ability to parameterize and work, you know, when you can run 1,000 simulations instead of one on a single single model, what that does to your workflow as a modeler, and what that does to your sort of attitudes towards your models. So, the basic infrastructure, right, and how this affects building energy modeling. The cloud computing has pretty fundamentally changed how we can access high-performance computing. It wasn't very long ago that if you wanted to use 200 or 400 or 1,000 CPUs, you had to have access to a very large institutional system, a cluster that's run by an institution that costs hundreds of thousands of dollars to install, requires, you know, a full-time worker to maintain and use it, and that that was basically usually unavailable to people unless they were associated with very large institutions. Now, but the nice thing about those is they were built specifically for high-performance computing, meaning that they shared a lot of resources. They were made for a lot of throughput. The current versions of these are like the supercomputers that you hear of that can run 93 petaflops at a time, which is a one calculation per second, which is 10 to the 15 calculations per second, 1,000 trillion. So these high performance, that's where high performance computing has gone in the realm of clusters. But for people who want to be able to use it, like most of us, that don't have access to that or don't need it, we have now cloud computing, which is a little bit different, and is sort of a child of that system. Instead of having to buy a large institutional system, with cloud computing, you basically have a pay-as-you-go system where you can rent one CPU or 100, you know, by the hour, and then turn them off when you're done, and you don't have any long-term costs associated with it. They're easy to access, but they're not built specifically for high-performance computing. They're basically single machines, usually virtual machines, running on clusters that are run by, you know, large corporations, but that open this up for us to use. So the difference is that as opposed to your local area network, let me see if I can get a pointer here. So this is your workstation at home, right? There's your workstation, and it's connected possibly to other computers and other things on your local area network, and that's usually connected by a fairly high speed like router or switch in your house or your office that allows you to work within your office fairly quickly. In a cloud environment, what you have instead is a host network, which is the actual data section, and you have a series of, what you do is you provide a series of virtual machines. So you rent the hardware, but in this case you provide your own operating system. You provide a machine image to be applied to the hardware, which means that you basically have to, you have the opportunity to provide your own operating system with all of the constituent software and setups and configurations that you like. On the other hand, you have to provide your own operating system. So those are machine images. There are a lot of, now for energy modelers, there are a lot of institutions that have built pre-canned machine images for us that have the various simulation programs and things on them that are configured well for us. But you can also make your own machine image if you want to basically log on, build a machine that is configured in the way that you like. You can save it, and then you can boot up 100 of them at the time if you'd like. So that's a sort of the advantage of a cloud computing system. On the other hand, you're using a virtual machine, so it's running on a high-powered system, but it is not directly. It's a machine running. It's an operating system running on an operating system that isn't connected to the hardware. And you have this one issue is that in your local area network where you're working at home, you have a fairly high-speed system. Within the host networks where all these machines are talking to each other, you usually have a very, very high-speed system. So communication between those machines, once it's in the cloud, is relatively fast. But there's a problem, there's a bottleneck in that if you want to pump a lot of information from your workstation up there for processing, you have to go through the public internet systems, which is usually slow. So these are sort of basic infrastructural things to keep in mind if you're going to start using cloud systems. The other thing that you need to know is that when you build a machine image as a virtual machine and start renting it by the hour, these machines are generally what they call headless, meaning that they don't have any graphical user interfaces. You can get machines that have graphical user interfaces, but they're rare. And so if you want to use these things directly, you're going to need to use the old, like, console-level communication systems, meaning you SSH in a secure shell into these machines, and you talk to them using Bash or DOS. And then so if you're going to get to that level, you need to be able to sort of be fluent in computer administrative sort of systems, right, which can be a heartache, frankly. But like I said, so that's why people, if you're going to do this, it's likely to be turned to third parties who have built these machines for you and sort of handle a lot of the talking of these machines between themselves. So why go through the trouble of using these systems? Sometimes you're going to have you're looking at the opportunity or problem of having to learn some new technologies, how to communicate with a computer through SSH, through Bash, how to write shell scripts. You know, some of these things are a real pain and are not, you know, ready. We're not all necessarily ready to jump into that. So if you want to do that, you can learn how to do that. There's also, like I said, people who will help you build those things. But if you go through the trouble of learning how to use these systems, you get a fair number of advantages. And those include, one, you can lighten the workload on your own computer, and that if you have a lot of computation you need to do, those computations can be shot out to another computer, and then your computer doesn't have all the CPU loads that it normally would have. Likewise, if you want to run 100 of those simulations, it's fairly simple to take 100 models and send them up, and they can all be running while you're working on something else. So you get a parallelism immediately. And I'd say energy models in particular are suited to this because they don't require a lot of parallelism within the simulation. As Nathaniel was talking about, each one runs sequentially. And so the parallelism in energy models that you gain is from running many variations of the model at once. Instead of running one model faster across many CPUs, it's not really set up to do that right now, but you can make gains by running many models at once that are different from each other. You can use these things if you're working remotely with different people to basically have a shared resource, a computation resource that you can work on from various sites. But mostly, you can take advantage of the parallelism that's inherent in these systems to work in a parametric way, which gives you access to a lot of different analysis tools than we've been able to use before. Instead of the sort of one model at a time, I'm building a model, I change it a little bit, I run a simulation, I change it a little bit, I run a simulation, and the model sort of evolves that way. In order to make use of these resources, our workflow has to change a little bit to become more in tune with parametric processes. A parameter, as I'm going to talk about it here, is basically a hook, I would say, that you can insert into your model that allows an algorithm that allows it to be modified algorithmically and in an automated manner, which means that software can now manipulate your model directly. So as far as parameters go, the simplest ones, if you're talking about a building energy model, would be simply modifying a field like a text replacement. Like the field goes, is now you have a field in a model, whatever it is, and it has a range, instead of just being the value 5, it now has a range between 3 and 7. And now you have a means to change that value, that one field, and you're basically replacing that one field in the model directly. More complicated things can manage many fields at once under one parameter, so you can lump them together and do a multi-parameter system. Or they can be really complicated and do drastic changes to the whole model under one parameter, like swapping out whole HVAC systems with a change of one parameter setting. Those systems are really just coming online now, but are pretty exciting. The ability to sort of manage models in really deep ways. But the key to this, as far as workflow goes and how we think about our models, is that instead of building a model, I would suggest that what we want to do if we want to make use of these systems is that we have to build more of a parameter space around our model. So instead of a model, right, that model, we would think of that model as one instance of a vast number of models that are similar to it, perturbations of that model. And that when you build and you parameterize your model, you would start to think about the parameter space that you're developing around that model. So if you put in one parameter into a model and you're able to change that in one dimension, that would be like a one-dimensional space. If you then do 3, you could think of that as a 3 space, and you can think about moving around in that parameter space. Each point in that parameter space is one instance of the model, one variation of the model. And what you're looking for when you're trying to optimize or something is a point in that parameter space where you have like good results, or an area of that parameter space that you've optimized for. And then as models get more complex, you have to start thinking about 10, 20, or 100 dimensional spaces, which are hard to visualize, and that's another problem, but that become very exciting because now your model becomes, you know, a much more dynamic system. Your single model becomes a dynamic system where you can look at trends in how the model behaves as things change instead of just points in space where you're simulating the model one point at a time. And once we've can sort of discuss models as, you know, a model that is associated with a parameter space and has a lot of variety, you gain the advantage of a lot of interesting analysis techniques that can inform how you design and how you work with these models in very interesting ways. So, sensitivity analysis would be one interesting use of this. It's the ability to take all the parameters that you have, and in, you know, a few short numbers of simulations, and by that I mean 100 to 1,000, you could take all the parameters and you can find out which ones actually have a significant effect on the output of the model and which ones don't, which means that you can say to your clients, or as you're working on the model, you can say, one, I need to pay attention to these parameters. These are important. They have a large effect on the output, and so I should take more time to find out if that's correct, if my assumptions are correct. And two, you can say these set of parameters at the bottom of this list actually have very little effect on the model. I can apply the defaults and not worry about any more, and even lock it in place and reduce your parameter space. You can say to your clients that because of this, because of our ability to sort of query the model and see how it behaves in a more in a metadata sort of way, you have a much more sort of experimentally defined way to say, like, the window to wall ratio is really important on this side of the building. We can't ignore it, you know. Like, these systems are important, but these systems perhaps are not important, and maybe other parts of the design process, that architectural systems that need to be brought into place, maybe those are best left to other influences on the building, like aesthetics and program and things like that. So it's a way to help define which decisions are most important. Uncertainty and risk analysis. Once you have a parametric model, you can do interesting things like do Monte Carlo sampling on the inputs and find out how much of a range of outputs you're likely to get from change to that. So if you're uncertain about the inputs to a model, or if you are interested in how much the price of electricity may affect the cost, the total costs associated with operating costs, and you, there's a range there, or if you want to know, any part of the model that you need to know what the risk is in knowing that value well or not knowing it, you apply a sampling technique where you can just sort of sample randomly or in a Monte Carlo fashion across the parameters, and then you can look at the outputs and say, if the output is in a, has a, is a, is a, probably a Gaussian and has a very tight level, it means that regardless of what my inputs are here, I can be pretty sure that the outputs are going to be in this range. But if you start sampling across some of your parameters and find that the output has a huge standard deviation, right, it means that there's a lot of risk associated with that input, that possible modifications to that input, assumptions you made, or things that don't play out as you expected could have a very large impact on energy use or whatever it is the output you're looking for. So risk analysis is made feasible by this. And then you also have the ability to use automation, searching algorithms, auto-calibration algorithms that you can apply once you have parameterized your model, and you can, these hooks are there that software can now change your model. You can do searching techniques, optimization techniques, which include auto calibration and things like that, which are extremely useful because, you know, without having to delve too far into it, the system will give you sort of a range of good answers. And then, you know, you can apply proper engineering knowledge to make sure that that seems reasonable and every other thing. But you get a really sort of metadata, high-level understanding of your models and how they behave across variations when you can use these systems. And then finally, when you have a lot of data, we have the issue of what does it look like when we have the results of 1,000 simulations? How are we gonna understand that? How are we going to view that? How are we going to make use of that and graphically so that we can understand it, so we can present it? And how are we going to make use of that to make good decisions? So there's a series of newer, more dynamic sort of graphical and visualization techniques that come out of the ability to run 1,000 simulations, which include dynamic things like parallel axis plots and other such things that I think we're really just starting to get into. I think that it's an open topic for how to really do good visualizations of parameter space and large, really large data sets that are related to the built environment. So that is, I would say, an ongoing topic for discussion. But basically, in the end, having talked about the cloud for quite a while, these systems are now available. And so when we go to use them, you should keep in mind that it may affect your workflow, it may affect how you interact with your model and how you view your model a little bit to make full use of these things. And I'll take questions.